Patrick Ryan's contribution to the IRA was transformative, and that is no exaggeration.
No.
No, he doesn't have any regrets. He doesn't have any remorse about his involvement, his role for the IRA, and what his role enabled the IRA to do. Without judgment, so that I can tell stories without judgment, and it's for other people who may read the book or may listen to this podcast who will make up their own mind about Patrick Ryan and his motivations.
Very
And
good. Thank you very much for joining me, Jen. I appreciate it. Congrats on the book. I hope I hope it's selling well. We'll crack straight into it there. We'll get into like actually Patrick Ryan, the man soon enough. But how did it happen that you linked up to do such a big project with him?
well, Patrick Ryan was somebody that I had never heard of until I was speaking to a source of mine about a story some years ago about a different IRA related story, and he passed. I mean, it was a throwaway remark at the time about there being a Ryan that I needed to speak to. And I remember that I wrote down the name in the corner of the notebook that I had at the time, and I didn't return to it until it was after a cold call to a stranger, who eventually that meeting culminated in me meeting with Patrick Ryan. And I guess the very first couple of times that I met with him, John, you know, he is very careful in what he says, and more importantly, what he doesn't say. So I say that to stress that, you know, even though I was introduced to him and we used to meet and speak, it's not as if he went straight or started to speak about his IRA related part of his life, you know, early on. It
Right.
took some time for him to open up about that. And eventually he agreed to go on camera and be interviewed for a BBC Northern Ireland series about the Troubles, The Secret History, that was broadcast in 2019. And after that documentary, you know, we kept in touch. I kept meeting him, albeit, you know, it was obviously paused during the pandemic. But there was a lot more of his story that had to be told, and he agreed that I could write the book. And that's what's led to the Padre. So a long road, and many meetings, and time in trying to get him to open up about different things and to tease out different parts of his life. But you know, I'm glad that the book is out there now for people to read.
Okay, obviously everyone's kind of shaped by the time they grow up in, you know, we can't help it. Patrick Ryan was born after the War of Independence and the Civil War. It was well finished by the time he was born, but long before the period known as the Troubles. Can you tell us a bit about maybe the people who would have influenced Patrick Ryan growing up, given that they were around during like the Civil War and the War of Independence?
But he was born in 1930, the second eldest son to Mary Ann and Patrick Ryan. His mother, Mary Ann, was somebody who, as a teenager, used to stand outside her home in County Tipperary to keep an ear out, literally, for the boots of the black and tans that were. They were the auxiliary force that were sent over by London during the Irish War of Independence to bolster the police force, which was under attack and depleted. And the details, you know, of Mary Ryan or Mary Ann Ryan and what she did during the Irish War of Independence are detailed in the book. But I mention her and her background. And her stories of what she did played a crucial role in informing her second eldest son's Patrick's Irish nationalism. You know, he grew up in a household where his mother would talk about what she did, and whether it was nature or nurture, you know, she passed on that deep patriotism and attitude towards militant Irish nationalism to her children, and in particular to Patrick. So he was never going to get the farm, because in those days the eldest son would automatically inherit the land. But Patrick, as a teenager, had already decided that he was going to join the seminary. And if you think about it this way, John, I mean, the Second World War had not ended when Patrick, you know, was 14 years of age, and he entered the junior seminary in Thurles, and 3 years later began his formal training to become a priest. And when he was ordained in 1954, I mean, it's difficult to, you know, our generation would find this difficult to, you know, to visualize, until, unless you know, watch the old footage. But in those days, there was a massive surplus of nuns and priests from Ireland that were literally sent abroad to expand, you know, what was described as Ireland's spiritual empire, and to work in the missions, be they in parts of Africa, parts of America, South America, elsewhere. And Patrick Ryan, in 1954, he heads to what was then called Tanganyika in East Africa. It later merged with Zanzibar and was renamed Tanzania. But he is there for over a decade. He gets stuck in terms of practical things he can do. He is drilling for water, building clinics, hospitals. That's what he finds most rewarding. You know, as he told me, he rather do that than stand around with a catechism, as he described it, in his hand. I mean, he went so far as, on his first trip back to Ireland, during his time as a missionary priest, on his first holiday home, if you like, he learned how to fly a plane, so that when he returned to East Africa, he was able to fly a two-seater between different clinics to deliver medicines. You know, I mention that because it's an early indication of his engineering capability and his character trait, that whatever he applies himself to, he will do so with absolute ruthless diligency. And so it passes, John, that he is back in Ireland in 1969, the year, the summer, of course, that what became known as the Troubles began to flare in parts of Belfast and in Derry, and eventually elsewhere. Now, he's back. He is working at that time. He is driving around Ireland for the Palatine Order. That's the order of priests that he had, you know, belonged to, if you like, in inverted commas. He's driving around the country, and he's collecting the coins that were tossed into the missionary boxes, you know, collecting the money that was given over for charity. And he starts redirecting that money to Republicans across the border. Now, he's canny out. At that stage, he's also made contact with IRA people in Tipperary, in County Tipperary, and he makes it known to them that he wants to get involved. He wants to help the Republican movement. His superiors in the order, you know, clearly there's a shortfall in the money that's being collected, and he comes clean and he tells them, he says what he was up to. They are appalled and ask him to return to his missionary work, and he decides that he will step away from the church and give himself over, if you like, to the IRA.
Oh.
And yeah, I mean, an incredible move at that time. Now, clearly there's a lot more detail in the book, in the Padre, about his time in East Africa, about his time in Tipperary, and beforehand, what led him to being in Ireland in 1969. But it is a certainly an interesting path that led him to that point.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so would you mind going into like the extent to which he carried out work for the IRA? N never joined them, interestingly enough. But I mean, he did. God, he went way beyond collecting a bit of money. At one stage, even I think some of the timers that he sourced were in the bomb that Patrick McGee planted. That nearly got Margaret Thatcher in Brighton.
His Patrick Ryan's contribution to the IRA was transformative, and that is no exaggeration. Not only was he the man dispatched to Libya to set up the channel, if you like, he was the link man between Muammar Gaddafi, who then, in the early 1970s, saw the IRA as comrades in arms fighting British imperialism. Patrick Ryan goes to Libya. He speaks five languages. He's highly educated, is used to dealing with all manners of people, sets up the link between Gaddafi and the IRA insofar as the money link. So he is responsible for collecting money in Europe and channeling it back to Ireland through a network of sleepers that he has set up, and he's also opened Swiss bank accounts. So transformative in terms of the money he provides, albeit from the Libyan regime to the IRA, many millions, he says. But it was while he was careering around Europe doing that, he was in Switzerland, in Geneva, and he spied what was then a little timer used by motorists. They were called Memo Park timers, and they were just small enough to put in your pocket to remind you that the money that you'd put in the meter for the car was about to run out, and it would kind of go off, and clearly you'd run back to the car and put money in, or move it elsewhere. Now, Patrick Ryan sees the little timer, and he knows of, well, it's a problem that the IRA, a challenge that the IRA have at that time for bomb makers, because there's a number of what the IRA described as own goals, where bombs would prematurely detonate, injuring or in some cases killing the bomb maker or the person who was planting the bomb. So he goes back and he buys a timer, decides that there must be a way that he can re-engineer it to effectively transform it to the capacity to use it as a safety to arm device as part of a bomb. He comes up with this template, sends it back to the IRA, buys up hundreds and hundreds of Memo Parks, and his plan and his re-engineering of the little timer works. It became a hallmark of IRA bombs from the mid-1970s onwards, used in scores of attacks. And of attacks, of course, where many civilians were killed, many British Army soldiers, policemen, children killed in IRA bombs. And Patrick Ryan's idea was a baseline, if you like, on which the IRA was able to improvise and expand its bomb-making capability. Because he, vis-a-vis the Memo Park improvisation, made it safer to train bomb makers, and it made it safer to plant IRA bombs. So Patrick Ryan, was a shadow in the background. Only an elite few within the Republican movement would have known of his existence, but his influence and what he did for the IRA was an incredible, but equally a horror for for the victims of IRA violence.
Of course, yeah, of course. It would have been it probably would have been like a slight waste if they had used him, or if he'd volunteered himself to do like up close like assassinations, given that he can get behind doors that most people couldn't. Did he ever talk about thinking about doing that kind of thing, or did he have any? Would he have had the stomach for for up close sort of violence? Now he obviously knew he was going to kill people with bombs, but that's it can be kind of out of sight and out of mind to a degree.
He is a person who is absolutely, ruthless in his determination, when he dedicates himself to something. So when he was in his role, for the IRA, he was essentially a money man, a type of fixer, a type of diplomat. He wasn't somebody who was ever meeting with active service units in Europe. Yes, he was meeting with senior IRA people in Europe, but he wasn't meeting a large number of people. He was cunning and he was crafty, and he says he was told from his intelligence contacts within the Libyan regime what was happening strategically within the IRA at different points. So Patrick Ryan was very much behind the scenes, but he had a hand in by proxy in many IRA attacks.
Right, I gotcha. At one stage, at one stage, he even carried out like spying work for Libyan intelligence in order to kind of foster good relations. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, Patrick Ryan told me that he believed that for the relationship, if you like, between the Republican movement, and the Libyan regime, for it to be profitable, there had to be a little bit of to and fro in terms of, what the IRA could do for the Libyan regime at times. And he says he did try and encourage that at times within his IRA contacts and the few times he returned to Ireland, but he says that they were less keen to volunteer themselves to work for Libyan intelligence, for example, in London or elsewhere. But Patrick Ryan says he was more than willing to help if appropriate, and there was an occasion, he says, where he was asked to travel to Sicily, off the coast of Italy, and spy on an American base, on behalf of Libyan intelligence. Now, the detail of what happened, is in the book, but it's an important facet of Patrick Ryan's character, in terms of he estimates and he takes his time to evaluate situations that he is in, and he takes his time to think about how best he can use a situation or a person to his advantage. And when he was traveling around Europe in the from the mid 1970s onwards and into the 1980s, I mean, that was a time of, Gaddafi was not only supplying finance to the IRA, he was also financing other terrorist organizations in Europe, such as ETA in terms of the Biedermeierhof gang in Germany, the Red Brigade also. So, I mention that because Europe at that time would have been quite an intense place for spies and for intelligence personnel from all manners of countries, and Patrick Ryan was right in the middle of it too.
You touched on you touched on something very interesting. I saw a quote I believe from Ryan. It says Libyan intelligence was able to tell me more about what was going on in the IRA than McGuinness ever did. And this was particularly interesting given that I also read that he had a bit of mistrust for the kind of the upper echelons of the IRA command, you know, McGuinness. Can you tell us a little about that? I found that fascinating, that quote from him.
Well, Patrick Ryan, when he returned to Ireland on the few occasions that he did, he was very much under the radar. You know, I say that because the point that he is making is that he's not sitting down with the Army Council discussing strategy and tactical maneuvers in terms of the IRA. He's meeting Martin McGuinness one to one, or in the story that's in the book, with somebody else for a different matter, you know, for IRA business. But he didn't trust Martin McGuinness. He didn't trust the leadership of the Republican movement, and it was his estimation that the Republican movement, or the IRA at a senior level, had been compromised, and was beset by agents and informers within its own ranks. And that was his estimation, and he was very careful in what he did when he traveled in Europe and subsequently back in Ireland. But no, he didn't like Martin McGuinness on a personal basis. And a lot of that is also based on a run-in that he had with Martin McGuinness in St. Stephen's Green in Dublin. And the detail of that is in the book.
Very interesting, very interesting. Did he, when you spoke about like the lives that he didn't take directly, but he made possible the taking of many lives. Did he differentiate ever between civilian and military slash government kind of targets? Because I know he's not like he's not at all remorseful about anything. He kind of I can't remember the exact quote, but he says he wishes he was more effective. So yeah, any differentiation between like civilian and like military targets?
No.
Really, he didn't he didn't go into any kind of nuance at all, no.
No, he doesn't have any regrets. He doesn't have any remorse about his involvement, his role for the IRA, and what his role enabled the IRA to do. His only regret is, and he says it in the book, that he regrets that the bombs he had a hand in weren't more effective. And that is a shocking statement for people to hear, and especially families of those who lost loved ones in IRA bombing attacks.
Did you get the sense at all this word gets thrown around quite a bit when we talk about kind of criminals and terrorism stuff, but did you get the sense at all that you were dealing with someone who might have like psychopathic tendencies, given that there's like an evident lack of empathy there?
I wrote the book, and I was very mindful, you know, not to, you know,
Diagnose.
that is not my it's not my job. It's my job to tell the story, to uncover and to shine a light, and to listen without judgment, so that I can tell stories without judgment. And it's for other people who may read the book or may listen to this podcast who will make up their own mind about Patrick Ryan and his motivations and what they think of him. But my own view is not important in the telling of this story. And neither did I romanticize anything that Patrick Ryan was involved in, and like I said, the book also, you know, contains the stories of some of the people who were affected by IRA attacks.
Okay, so we're coming to the end there. How was it that Patrick Ryan kind of like quit the movement or broke from it?
Well, Patrick Ryan was eventually tracked down in Belgium in 1988. Now, when I say tracked down, yes, of course, British intelligence knew of his existence at that stage. He has a base in Spain. He's set himself up in Benidorm, which was a canny move, and the details of why are in the book. So he is moving between countries in Europe at that stage. He is no longer the link man between Libya and the IRA. His main focus at that stage was in Europe and, being what he describes as a shadow in the background. He was arrested in Brussels in 1988, and the British government, which was then, of course, headed by Margaret Thatcher, wanted him extradited to London. And that diplomatic wrangle became quite intense between the two governments, in terms of the London government wanting to put Patrick Ryan, wanting to put Patrick Ryan before the courts in London. Now, Brussels, the government in Belgium eventually decided, and it is intriguing why and what led up to this, but they decided that they would not extradite Patrick Ryan to London, that they would instead repatriate him back to Dublin. Now, in the meantime, he had gone on hunger strike while he was being detained in a Brussels prison. But Patrick Ryan was flown on a Belgian military plane from Brussels to Dublin, avoiding British airspace. And when he returned to Ireland, he went to ground for a time, again causing a fierce diplomatic row between the governments in London and Dublin this time. The British government also wanted him extradited from Dublin to London. That too failed in 1989. And at that stage, Patrick Ryan had a decision to make. He says that he decided to walk away fully from the Republican movement. He said there was an opportunity to, as he describes it, set up another outfit, a breakaway group, a militant breakaway group. But at that stage, it was his estimation that decision would have been lambs, as he describes it, lambs to the slaughter. So he walked away entirely. And he had already fallen out, if you like, between with the leadership of the Republican movement. And he w is pragmatic and was pragmatic in the 1990s, he says, about the move towards the Good Friday Agreement and peace agreements. So Patrick Ryan, became a civilian, if you like, from the early 1990s onwards. He never returned to his priestly duties. He never practiced as a priest again. It was 1990 when he was formally dismissed from the Palatine Order. But it's an incredible story, and one that I don't think a lot of people would have been aware of in terms of the extent of what he did and what he was involved in during his role working for the IRA.
I was going to say, yeah, to call him a fascinating character would be an understatement. One small little thing, sorry, I'll let you go. How does he reconcile, like Christianity and being a good Christian with everything he's done? Does he even like nowadays? Does he still consider himself, like a Christian who tries to live by the Ten Commandments and that kind of thing?
Patrick Ryan is somebody who lives by his own code, and he is somebody who, he's 93 years of age now, and he still is quite, the steeliness that would have been on display at times, during his earlier life. You can see it in flashes at times in conversations with him. He is not a religious person, but he believes in whatever ideology he turns his attention to at whatever particular point in his life, he does so. You know, for years and years, he was dedicated to the Catholic Church and its teachings, albeit he was more interested in, you know, rolling up his sleeves and getting involved in a practical sense. But so too, when he gave himself over to the IRA, he gave all of himself over. You know, he was never not looking out for opportunities that could advance the cause of militant Irish republicanism. So Patrick Ryan, you know, he's an outwardly gentle person. He is mannerly. He is charismatic. But they are all the traits that he would have also employed many decades ago when he was traveling in Tripoli or traveling, you know, across the capitals of Europe on behalf of the IRA.
Indeed. Jennifer, thank you very much. The insight you've given us into Patrick Ryan and the book. I'd highly encourage everyone to read it. I'll link it in both the YouTube and the podcast description. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with there as a comparing thought?
No, I'm really delighted to get the opportunity to speak to you. And you know, if anybody has any feedback, you know, I'm on Twitter and people can, you know, can email me or give me any feedback about the book. And you know, I really do hope that people come to it, you know, and read. You know, it is a very difficult part of Irish history, you know, for many people to read. And of course, it's not something that is in the past for many thousands of families who were, you know, affected by the IRA's campaign of violence, and also the families, you know, who were also affected in the wider troubles of violence. So, you know, it's history for so many, but it's not for a large number of people.
Thank you very much. I hope the book sells well. Possibly, maybe. I mean, it does sound like the kind of thing that would make a great TV series or film. So maybe something like that in the future.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Jennifer.